Should we get started on this one then?
Yeah, go on, quick.
Okay.
The CMU podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Spotify, Safe Harbours and Theresa May. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt. Chris Cook is in the studio, where once again, I am not.
Because technically you're on holiday.
Yeah, I'm on holiday, but I thought I'd do a podcast anyway because I just like it so much.
You're by the seaside having a lovely holiday, but despite that, you've decided to phone in to the studio to record a podcast to discuss all the key developments in the music business this week, even though you don't know about any of the key developments in the music business this week because you're on holiday.
I've read about them now.
Have you?
Yeah, you know, a bit. I scanned it.
You quickly read up on all the key stories after I told you what we should talk about.
Yeah, basically.
Okay, well, we'll see how that turns out when we start grilling you for information on all of this week's big stories. We're not going to be here next week because I'm going to be in Cannes. That's also by the seaside. A different seaside, though, isn't it? Different sea. Although they're all connected, aren't they, really, if you think about it?
Yes, I suppose they are.
You could sail from Margate to Cannes. That is a conceivable. It'd be quite a long way round doing it, but you could do it.
Well, as we discussed, I think recently on the podcast, I once sailed from Essex to Denmark,
which probably isn't that much further.
It took 19 hours, so that's and it wasn't really sail. I wasn't a ferry. People shouldn't think that I sailed there
on your posh yacht. Happened. So I am not...
It was not a posh yacht.
I am not sailing to Cannes. I'm flying to Cannes. But it's MeDem next week, and I am moderating a panel on safe harbours, more on which soon on this edition of the podcast.
Yeah, as usual, we're discussing safe harbours.
So there'll be no podcast next week to discuss safe harbours, but if you're missing all the chat about safe harbours that comes with every single edition of this goddamn podcast, then come to Cannes, MeDem, and hear me chatting about it there. Or I think MeDem stream most of their stuff, don't they?
I think they do.
They certainly have done in the past.
You could watch it live.
I probably should have looked that up, but there might be an option too. I'm also potentially doing another very interesting panel that hasn't been confirmed yet, so I can't tell you about it because it might not happen. But if it does, it'll be very interesting, and I might write it up as a CMU trends report because it's that interesting. I won't write up the safe harbours one as a trends report because, you know, it's dull and tedious. No, it's going to be a really interesting debate. It's going to be the highlight of the MeDem conference. So, yeah. So
I absolutely believe that it will be.
So that's next week. So we're not going to be here next week. It's another week off. We've not long had a week off.
But after that, I think that we've got a pretty good run of it.
Is that what you're thinking?
We're going to stop taking weeks off. We're going to get consistent again.
We're going to run all the way through to the year 2028 without a break.
Yes.
Is that what you're thinking?
Yes. That is the plan.
Later, there's a reason why that might not work because I might not be here 1 week in July, but that doesn't matter. Let's not worry about that. Do you know, later on this month, because we're now in June, did you notice that we're now in June?
I had to check and I did notice.
I've not checked the old tabloid newspapers this morning or all the broadsheet newspapers for that basis. I've not checked any newspapers this morning, but I wondered whether, I mean, it would have to be a left-leaning paper. So I guess it would be the Mirror as the left-leaning tabloid in the UK. Mm-hmm. Has anyone gone, because obviously, as we record this, last night was the BBC general election debate where Theresa May didn't show up. She seems to be getting quite a lot of slack for that. And I wondered whether, the obvious headline to run with, given it's the 1st of June, would have been, is this the end of May? Or something along those lines. Is the end of May the end of May? Something like that. But
That's already been a hashtag, hasn't it?
Has it? I thought I was being original.
Make June the end of May. That's been going around. You were not being original. In fact, you probably saw that somewhere and now think it's your own original idea.
Do you think I subtly, sort of subconsciously saw that in my Facebook feed? And now I think...
Yes.
And now I'm lining myself up to go and get a job writing headlines for the Daily Mirror. And they'll just laugh in my face and say, that's such an obvious headline. Anyway, I went on a slight tangent there. What I meant to say is it's now June, okay? Mm-hmm. And later this month, on one of the days of June, I can't quite remember which, somewhere about two-thirds of the way through, it will be the 15th birthday of the CMU Daily. Not CMU Blimey. At large, but the CMU Daily, that thing that lands in your inbox every morning, will have landed in your inbox every day, every weekday, not the weekends, but every day since June 2002. That's right. That would make it 15 years, wouldn't it? So 15 years of CMU Daily. So I'm sure for that occasion, Andy Malt will be selecting what he considers to have been the biggest news stories of the 15 years that CMU has been covering the music business on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that's what I'll do.
That feature. That's
what I did. I did do 10 for the 10th anniversary, didn't I?
Did you?
I probably should. I think I did, yeah.
I didn't even remember that. It's a sort of cheesy feature we might have done. In those days, we had the weekly, didn't we? The thing that used to go out on a Friday.
Yeah, it possibly went out in that.
It's the sort of thing we would have
anyway,
put in
yeah, that. 15 years.
15 years of the CMU Daily. Do you know...
I have been receiving it since the beginning.
Yeah, I've been writing it since the beginning.
Yeah, I don't think I read it for about the first year, but I received it from the beginning.
That suggests that you didn't sign up for it and that we somehow added you to the list, but that would be illegal, so we can't possibly have done that. I'm not sure it was illegal.
I vaguely remember being asked.
I think if you, because obviously you used to receive the print magazine when there was such a thing.
I did, yeah.
And I think at some point, as a subscriber to the print magazine, you probably gave us your email address, and at that point you ticked a box that said, I would like to receive emails from CMU, and that's how you ended up with it. In the early days of the CMU Daily, we used to do quiz questions. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Perhaps
yes.
We should bring that back for the 15th year. A quiz question every day. It did used to sometimes take longer writing the quiz question than the rest of the CMU Daily.
Yeah, but that's exactly why I don't think we should bring it back.
But we obviously felt that we needed a gimmick at the start, and I'm sort of feeling 15 years on, perhaps we need a gimmick again, so we'll have to think of something anyway. We all really ought to start talking about this week in the music business. I'm waffling because I realise you've not got a lot to say about this week's music business stories, so therefore we might get through them quicker.
I've got loads to say.
Well, get going then.
Okay, well, I was thinking that before we get onto that, we should probably mention Meltdown as well.
Oh, we definitely should. Well done. I'm glad you remembered that.
Because there won't be a podcast before Meltdown, because we're off next week, as previously discussed.
Very good point. I'm glad you're on the ball, even though you're on holiday.
Yeah.
So well,
my mind never stops working.
Yeah, so Meltdown kicks off not this coming weekend. Well, in terms of listening to the podcast, this is a really rubbish way of describing it. MIA's Meltdown kicks off on the 9th of June, which is coming up very soon, and it's a brilliant programme that she has put together on the South Bank in London for the, I don't know how long it runs for, a couple of weeks through much of the rest of June. But crucially, on the first weekend, MIA decided that she wanted to have a few conversations about the state and future of this business of music and the process of making music and being a musician and an artist in this here streaming, digital, direct-to-fan, social media age. And the guys at Meltdown, very kindly came and spoke to us, and so we have compiled some conversations. So we're going to talk about three different things, some of which we've talked about at The Great Escape in the past, or indeed here on the podcast, but some very interesting conversations. So what are we going to look at? We're going to look at music and the machines, so looking at sort of AI and music recognition technology and how that is changing the way that we consume music, but also could the machines make the music? That is something we talked about on the podcast late last year, I think. And so we'll be having that conversation, and also looking at how some of those sort of AI technologies that sort of analyze and classify and make music work. We are also going to be looking at the science of sound, which will be really interesting, and why certain things sort of sound pleasurable and certain things don't. And we're going to be looking at that from a sort of a creative musical perspective, but also from a commercial perspective. What kind of music, what kind of sound makes you buy more? Because people have done that research. They know what tracks to play on those in-store systems and how different sounds can affect human emotions. So obviously, that's also very relevant to music supervision, the people who put music together for soundtracks and things like that. And then in the middle, we are going to be looking at, I suppose, what we talked about on last week's podcast, which is the music community becoming increasingly political in this sort of polarized political age. It will be just after the general election. And so we'll be looking at how musicians have become more political, whether that's through their songwriting or through the stuff they sell. USA or the alliances that they form. And also, I suppose, obviously, we spoke last week about how the grime community in particular have been encouraging young people to take an interest in this election and to vote for the first time, the message being your vote will make a difference. But I think it will be interesting. I mean, obviously, we don't know because there's an election between us and this conversation. But if, as I think most people still assume, although things are sort of going a bit weird, aren't they? But I think most people still assume that Theresa May will win next Thursday in the general election. Although it is now... Well, last week you were being very sort of blasé about that, weren't you? Sort of saying, oh, it's going to be Theresa May and the Conservatives. They're definitely going to win the general election. And I think that is still the case. But the opinion polls are doing that sort of weird thing that they often do in the run-up to the election, where it's making it look very close. You always have to remember that the people who commission these opinion polls are media. And media want it to be close. Even media that have a very strong political opinion one way or the other. Commercially, they want the election to be close because then everyone starts reading the newspapers and watching TV and stuff like that. So it may not be as close as it seems. But let's say Theresa May does win. So in essence, the status quo is renewed. Then what does that mean for all the young people who got engaged in politics because you can make a difference? Yeah. And they might immediately say, well... we didn't. We didn't make a difference. And so how can artists and musicians keep those people engaged and say, well, that's not the point. You need to keep campaigning on the issues that interest you in the foreseeable future. So these are all the things we're going to be talking about as part of MIA's Meltdown on the first weekend of the festival on the Saturday afternoon, the 10th of June. It's basically free sessions over the afternoon. If you go to completemusicupdate.com/events... you will find all the information there. Click through to the Meltdown page. And, of course, all the other stuff that we've got coming up as CMU Insights and CMU DIY, etc. So, yeah, should be exciting. Do come along. I think Meltdown are recording them. I think Rinse FM may be recording them. So hopefully they'll be available for you to listen to online if you can't make it. And we'll let you know more about that on a future podcast.
Yes, but now we really do need to get on to this actual podcast.
Because apparently you've got a lot to say.
I've got a lot to say and we haven't got that much longer left to record it in. So let's just get on with it. So coming up this week, we've got the battle over new safe harbour legislation in Europe hotting up. We've got more Theresa May chat and her appearance in the UK singles chart. But first, Spotify has done something that I think we recently predicted would not happen on this very podcast. And that is that it settled the class action lawsuit that it faced over unpaid mechanical royalties in the US.
I can't believe I would have predicted something wrong. So I think that must have been you. If that's true, I think we should go back and check. I bet it was you saying that. And I was saying...
It looked very unlikely that this would happen, and yet it has.
Yes, so this is a story that not only have we talked about at great length on the podcast, but you may remember last summer in the very unusual edition of the podcast where we actually allowed a guest on. It's amazing how often at the moment I'm being pitched by PRs in the music industry, people to come on as guests on our podcast. And I don't know whether to take that as, you know, that's exciting, people want to come on our podcast, or whether that's a sort of... Well, do these people not listen to our podcast? Do they not realise we don't have guests? Why do they keep pitching people? Except that last summer, we did have one edition where I sat down with the musician and songwriter David Lowry, who was one of the key players in launching this litigation. And we spoke about, well, both the technicalities and legalities and also his motivation behind it. So shall I try and do the quickest, fastest recap of what this dispute was about?
Yes, really quick.
Really quick. I'm going to take some water first.
Okay.
Okay, let's see if I can remember this. So, if you are a streaming service and you're streaming recordings of people's songs, you obviously need to get yourself some licenses from the music industry so that you're doing that legally. You're not infringing anybody's copyright. So every streaming service, when they come along in any one country, they need to sort out their licenses. And obviously there are two music rights. There is the recording rights and the song rights. So immediately you have to do two sets of licenses. One around recordings and one around songs. This was all about the copyright in songs. So, when you're licensing your streaming service, not only do you need to make sure that you've got licenses to cover the recording copyright and the song copyright, you also need to dig a bit deeper than that. Because a copyright comes of a number of controls, and so often, particularly in music publishing, we talk about the mechanical rights and the performing rights, and a stream basically exploits both of those. So whereas in the olden days, a CD just exploited the mechanical rights of a song, and a radio broadcast just exploited the performing rights of a song, once you start streaming music, you're exploiting both elements of the copyright. Now you might say, well, who cares? That's just tedious semantics, and on one level it is. Except that in some countries, the music publishing sector, which represents the song copyrights, has traditionally licensed the mechanical rights and the performing rights separately. So here in the UK, There are two collecting societies for song rights. There is PRS, that represents the performing rights, and there is MCPS, that represents the mechanical rights. Although MCPS basically outsources all of the work to PRS, and one thing that happened while we were away doing The Great Escape was that MCPS confirmed that it was renewing its relationship with PRS, so that will continue. So although in theory there are two societies representing the two elements of the song copyright in the UK, actually, as a service, I can go to PRS and they represent both elements of the copyright. So in the UK, even though technically the two elements of the songwriter are dealt with separately, it doesn't really matter because you've got a collecting society for both sides and actually they collaborate and work together. The problem is in the US. The problem is always in the US. And the problem in America is that although there are collecting societies for the performing rights, so the equivalent of PRS, there are actually four of them, the big two, BMI and ASCAP, and then the small two, CSAC and Global Music Rights. So you can sort out the performing rights through the collective licensing system just like you can in the UK and elsewhere. But on the mechanical rights side, there is no American equivalent of MCPS. So the American music publishers have never set up a one-stop, industry-wide mechanical rights collecting society. There is an organisation called the Harry Fox Agency that used to be owned by the music publishers' trade body that sort of does a similar job to MCPS, but it's not a true collecting society. It's simply a middleman agency. So when you arrive...
And it will only get you about 70% of the rights, won't it?
Yes. So when you arrive in the American market, you can't just go to the Mechanical Rights Society, get a license, and then let them sort out who needs to be paid for the songs that you have exploited. You can get the Harry Fox Agency to sort out about 70% of the licensing, but there's still a gap. And so there will always be some songwriters and publishers whose songs you've used, who the Harry Fox Agency don't know who they are, so they can't get the money to those people. Now, there is what we call a compulsory license for mechanical rights in the US. So under American copyright law, if you're a copyright owner in a song, you are obliged to provide a mechanical rights license if somebody asks for it and the rates are set in law. So on one level, you can say, well, there's a compulsory license. That's nice and simple. We don't need a collecting society. So when Spotify arrives in the US, it just says, OK, we'll do our deals with the labels on the recording side. We'll do our deals with BMI and ASCAP, etc. on the performing rights side. And then we'll just use this compulsory license for mechanical rights and we'll hire the Harry Fox Agency to get the money to the right people. However, what the compulsory license says under American law is if you're using the compulsory license, you need to let the owners of every song you are exploiting, so every song you are streaming, you need to let the copyright owner know that you are using their song under the compulsory license, and then you basically ask them where you should send the money. And so the Harry Fox Agency was helping with that process, getting about 70% of the songwriters and publishers, the paperwork done and the money flowing through. But what about the other 30%? And the Harry Fox Agency didn't get those people. Spotify didn't find those people. And so therefore, some of those people, and David Lowery was one of them, came forward and said, well, hang on a second, you've been streaming my music. It doesn't matter that you've been paying for the recording rights through the label and for the performing rights in the song through the societies. You haven't been paying the mechanical royalties. Okay, there's a compulsory license, but it says you need to file some paperwork either with me as the rights owner or with the US Copyright Office if you don't know where the rights owner is. You haven't done that. That's copyright infringement. I'm going to sue you. I'll have millions of pounds of damages, please. And I suppose that's where we were last summer when we spoke to David Lowery. And this wasn't the only lawsuit. So first of all, other streaming services have been sued on this by songwriters and smaller music publishers. And in terms of Spotify, there was David Lowery's lawsuit. That was a class action. And then there was another very similar lawsuit that was pursued by another songwriter and artist called Melissa Ferrick. And so both of those class actions were filed. They were subsequently merged in court. And as I understand it, once the two class actions have been merged, it was the lawyers working for Melissa Ferrick rather than the lawyers working for David Lowery who then led on the out-of-court negotiations with Spotify, which ultimately, in the last week, have reached a settlement.
Yes, so there's going to be a fund set aside worth $43.4 million to compensate songwriters and publishers whose songs had been streamed without a licence.
So that money will be both paying the royalties they should have been paid at the compulsory license rate for all of the streams of their music, but there will also be a compensation element of that because it's not just the unpaid royalties. The argument is, well, you infringed our copyright and therefore we are due damages. So if you are a writer or a publisher who is part of this class, then you will be due some money, both the royalties that you're due anyway because your songs were streamed, although in some cases probably that won't be that much money because some of the writers and publishers involved in this, probably their music hasn't actually been streamed that often. However, there may be some damages as well. Quite how they're going to work out how they divvy up that money, I don't know. It's worth remembering that shortly after these lawsuits were filed, the National Music Publishers Association, who, as I mentioned, used to own the Harry Fox agency, but has certainly the bigger music publishers and its membership, it did its own settlement with Spotify.
Yes.
And a similar arrangement, or a pile of money, was set aside. So writers and publishers were said, if you come and sign up to this settlement, then you'll get a share of this money, both your unpaid mechanicals to date and a little bit of compensation. But a condition of signing up to the NMPA settlement was that you wouldn't then join in with the David Lowery and Melissa Ferrick class actions. So as a writer or a publisher who controls the rights in songs who hadn't been paid through the existing system set up by a Harry Fox agency, you then had to make a decision, which is, OK, do I sign up to the NMPA settlement or do I sign up to the class action? We've not yet had the specifics of the class action settlement. Also, all of that, because it's a class action, has to be approved by the court. So it's basically still, in essence, a draft proposed settlement at the moment, and it will have to be signed off by the judge. But assuming it is, we're yet to work out the specifics of how they're going to divvy up this money. And I suppose there is some maths to be done there of, you know, with hindsight, there's nothing you can do about this now, but with hindsight, if you were, say, a self-publishing writer who hadn't been getting their mechanicals from Spotify, I wonder which it would have been better to do, to sign up to the NMPA settlement, which was agreed last year, or to have sort of stuck with the class action. I suspect the latter, those writers will probably be seeing more money through the class action than through the NMPA settlement. Having said that, I've not seen the specifics, so I don't actually know that. It will be interesting to see.
The other thing that has been proposed in this settlement is that the two sides will go on to work collaboratively to improve the gathering and collecting of information about composition owners to help ensure those owners are paid their royalties in the future. Presumably that just means handing over the names of everyone who is on the class action, because they're not going to pay to build a database. Melissa Ferrick and David Lowery, I assume.
Yes, they personally aren't going to, because they were quite clear from the start that one of the reasons they were pursuing this litigation was they were of the opinion that services like Spotify should have spent some of the millions and millions of venture capital they raised building that database. Yes, of course, that brings back to the sort of the side debate to all of this. There are plenty of people within the music community who have been actually quite supportive of Spotify in this dispute, in saying, we agree that Spotify, in essence, are in the wrong because they haven't paid the mechanical royalties that they were due on a whole load of songs that they have streamed. And yes, technically under American law, that is copyright infringement. However, one of the reasons they weren't paying this money was because they didn't know who to pay. Because there is no one-stop database that will tell you who controls every single song that's ever been published. So which publishers, which writers, which collecting societies, what the splits are. More importantly than that, there's not even a database that tells you if this is the ISRC code attached to a recording that a record company has given you, this is the song that is contained in that recording, and therefore these are the publishers, the writers and societies. So the music industry has a massive database gap, and that was a huge contributing factor to this. And in most other countries, that database also doesn't exist. But because there was a mechanical rights society like MCPS in the UK, the Spotifys of the world could basically outsource all of that work and just say, OK, we've done a deal. Here's the money. You work out who to pay. They couldn't do that in the US because there wasn't a straight equivalent of MCPS. And so therefore, somebody needs to set up a system to ensure that everybody gets paid their mechanicals. The NMPA, with their settlement, also said, oh, we're going to work with Spotify on building a database. We're still waiting to see exactly what that means. And yes, part of this deal is we're going to collaborate on this database. And I suppose there remains that debate about, well, who should build this database? Should the services be building it? Or should the music industry be building it, and who should pay for it? And some people, and I think probably David Lowery and Melissa Ferrick would probably say this, is, well, the streaming services want to use our music, they've raised all this money, they're technology companies, they should build the database. But you could flip that round and say, but is it efficient to have every single streaming service building a database? Surely it would be better for the music industry to build a database. And of course, lots of people are. Lots of people are trying to build this one-stop database. Different societies, different startups are working on this. It may or may then get distributed by the blockchain, we will see. So there are lots of people trying to solve this problem, but for the time being, it is still a problem. So it remains to be seen if these settlements, the NMPA settlement last year, the settlement of the class action now, Whether that will result ultimately in putting the pressure in the right places that this song rights database will be made and paid for and exist. And on that interview we did with David Lowry on the podcast last year, I mean, one of the things that he said was that part of his motivation wasn't for a big payday. He was sort of suing on a point of principle. And one of his arguments was, it's mad that there isn't a decent system in the US for distributing mechanical royalties. Maybe that is as much the fault of the music industry and the music publishing sector as it is the streaming services, but we need that system to put in place. And he was almost saying, I can't quite remember, I think he pretty much overtly said this, the way you get stuff like that done in America is you sue. I mean, yeah. You could try going to Congress and getting copyright law rewritten, but that would probably take about 20 years, particularly at the moment. So the best thing to do is to sue, and then people sort of, you know, get off their asses and fix these problems. So let's hope they do, because that certainly, when we spoke to him, that was a big part of his motivation. And so even if everybody gets a nice little check out of this, if there isn't a system in place to ensure that everybody across the board starts to receive their mechanical royalties in an effective way, all the writers, all the music publishers, well, he hasn't achieved what he set out to do. So it remains to be seen what happens with this. But it is interesting that Spotify have managed to find a way of settling the case. It's quite an expensive settlement for them, over $43 million, plus a commitment to sort of sort out all the data stuff, so more spend there. Although, with Spotify looking to list itself on the New York Stock Exchange at some point in the next year, it will be very helpful to have this really messy bit of litigation out of the way.
Yes, so definitely more to come on that story, but for now, it looks like the legal part of that story has been closed. Okay, still to come, we've got our news in brief for this week, plus Theresa May's assault on the charts. But now, let's get those safe harbours talked about, because they're not going to talk about themselves. In fact, they have been talking about themselves this week, kind of.
Well, other people have been talking about them.
Yes, all right. Let's just gloss over the fact that that was a really messy intro to this section.
Okay, let's ignore the intro and let's get going. So yes, safe harbours are back in the news. We're not going to explain what safe harbours are, because as Andy likes to say, go and pick any edition of the See Me podcast from the archives and you will find an explanation. Or go to seemuinsights.com, click on the blog, and somewhere halfway down that page you'll find my 5-point explanation of safe harbours. But all you need to know is safe harbours are a bit of copyright law that the music industry doesn't like. What the music industry doesn't like is the fact that services like YouTube get to use these safe harbours, which gives YouTube a stronger negotiating hand, which is why YouTube, although it has licenses with the record companies and the music publishers and the collecting societies, it generally pays a lot less into the music industry than, say, services like Spotify. The music industry doesn't like that. It says the safe harbours are to blame, and so therefore it wants safe harbour rules rewritten so that when it negotiates with YouTube, it has a stronger negotiating hand. And in Europe, where copyright law is being reviewed through a new European copyright directive, there is an article in that copyright directive which is attempting to restrict the safe harbour slightly so that possibly services like YouTube would no longer apply. And that is all going through the motions. It's currently in Brussels. The European Parliament are debating it. The EU Council are debating it. There are a ridiculous number of amendments being considered. And because it's very much on the agenda in Brussels at the moment, various organisations have been organising events and putting out open letters. And I suppose what's been interesting in the last 7 days is we've seen people from both sides of this debate speaking. We've had one side saying, we need to fix this. Actually, we should make the article on safe harbours and the directive even tougher. And then on the other side, we've got people saying, this is all the nonsense. We should delete this entire article of the directive and shut up about the safe harbours and the bloody value gap.
Yes, so at the Meet the Authors event, which is staged by GSAC, which is a group that brings together European collecting societies that represent song rights, said, unless clear and strong legislation is adopted at an EU level, free riding platforms will continue to have carte blanche for siphoning value from creative and cultural works for their own profit, depriving Europe of one of its main economic assets, the creative sector.
Yes, so that was an event in Brussels organised by that organisation, GSAC, bringing together lots of songwriters. And I suppose what is interesting about the whole safe harbour debate on the music side is it is something that brings together most of the stakeholders. So labels are talking about this, publishers are talking about this, artists are talking about this, songwriters are talking about this, and they're all calling for this safe harbour reform. And I think actually the songwriters, I think, are becoming the most vocal, although originally it seemed to be the labels that were leading on it. The songwriters are now being particularly vocal on this. And so, yes, at this event, there were lots of songwriters there. There were music publishers there. There were MEPs. There were sort of decision makers from different European governments. And an assortment of songwriters either got up and spoke, or a lot of them put out statements ahead of the event. Songwriters from all over Europe, and being quite emotive in their language and saying things like, you know, these free riding platforms. And whereas sometimes some of the early statements, particularly from sort of the lobbying organisations and the trade bodies, they got this phrase, the value gap, didn't they? And they tend to talk about the value gap. Whereas some of these statements were basically saying, YouTube is screwing us over, they're putting us out of business, and you, lawmakers of Europe, you need to fix this. So some quite emotive speaking at this Meet the Authors event.
But on the other side of the argument, a group called Copyright for Creativity, which represents tech firms, libraries, digital rights campaigners, etc., published an open letter which called for Article 13 of the draft copyright directive to be scrapped altogether. And they said that the provision on the so-called value gap is designed to provoke such legal uncertainty that online services will have no other option than to monitor, filter, and block EU citizens' communications if they want to have any chance of staying in business. The Commission's proposals misrepresents some European court rulings and seeks to impose contradictory obligations on member states. This is simply bad regulation.
Yeah, they don't want any reform of the safe harbour. So as you say, this organisation, which, what was its name again?
Copyright for Creativity.
Copyright for Creativity. So there are various organisations signed up to that campaign, mainly representing either tech firms, so internet service providers and web companies. A lot of libraries, though, very much on the side of the tech giant, as well as the organisations which are formally allied to Copyright for Creativity. An assortment of other organisations put their name to this open letter that was basically saying, this is a terrible proposal, it's going to screw everything up, and actually we should just delete it. I suppose we should go back to what we've said throughout, ever since the draft European Copyright Directive was published last summer, which is that whatever your opinion on whether or not safe harbour should be reformed, the way it is currently written, it would only affect really big online platforms. So on the tech side, people are saying, oh, this will screw up small companies and startups. And it's like, well, the article has been very much written that we're only talking about big platforms on the internet. Now, how do you define big, I suppose, is an issue. But that's very much what it says. And as we've said before, it's trying to be written to mainly target YouTube and maybe two or three other services, maybe Facebook, maybe Dailymotion, although obviously it's reinventing itself voluntarily. But it's very much focused on aiming at a small number of platforms, and particularly YouTube. But the flip side is, I think, despite the tech sector saying this will be a disastrous piece of legislation, there is enough wiggle room in the safe harbour article of the directive as it is written that YouTube in particular will be immediately able to say, meh, we're already compliant with this, so we don't need to change anything that we do. Which I suppose comes back to the thing that we've been saying, which is that even if you think that the music industry is 100% right in pushing for safe harbour reform, there is the issue of, will this article actually deliver anything? Let's say it goes through in its current draft and YouTube don't get it rewritten, or this organisation don't get it deleted, and it does go through in its current form. Even that, will it be any help to all these songwriters who seem to increasingly think that if we could just fix safe harbours, everything will be fine again. But I guess this is what we'll be discussing with that panel at MeDem. So hopefully we'll get a few different opinions from our panel of music industry representatives when we ask them that very question.
Yes, and we'll find a way, if you can't get to MeDem, to get the results of that panel back to you, hopefully via a video of the event itself.
Who knows? We'll see.
Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. Tidal has lost yet another CEO. This time, Jeff Toig, who managed to stay in the job for 18 months, which is pretty good going in Tidal CEO terms.
Yes, so after Jay-Z bought Tidal in 2015, they went through three CEOs in about 6 months.
Yes.
And so this guy was the third CEO that took over Tidal on Jay-Z's watch. So he was there for about 15 months, which I suppose isn't that bad. But it is still, well, they're yet to announce the new CEO. We're expecting an announcement on that very soon, but that will be the fourth CEO in less than 2 years, which doesn't look that good for a company that is yet to really prove that it's going to be a going concern long term. But who knows? Perhaps they'll bring in a genius and he or she will turn Tidal into the number one streaming platform worldwide. Although I think that would require quite a genius.
Two Sony Music-owned companies, Red Essential and The Orchard, are going to merge and become The Orchard.
Yes. So, as we know, the major record companies in the last 10 years have all grown their so-called label services businesses. So I suppose what back in the olden days of the record industry was called the distribution divisions of the record companies, they are now sort of services companies. And it's always been a little bit confusing at Sony. Through various acquisitions in recent years, they've acquired a number of different businesses that are working in this space. So they have their own label services business called Red. Last year, they acquired Essential, that used to be part of the Cooking Vinyl Group here in the UK, and they merged it to create Red Essential. But over here, they also own The Orchard, which began its life as an independent digital distributor, added all sorts of other services on top, and Sony acquired a bit of it, and then more of it, and has owned The Orchard outright for some time. So it has always seemed a little bit odd that Sony, in essence, has two businesses doing the same thing. Red Essential, that has always seemed to be a little bit closer to Sony itself, and then The Orchard, which, although wholly owned by Sony Music, seems to operate a little bit more autonomously. But anyway, here in the UK, they are officially merging. They are not going to be known as Red Essential The Orchard, or the Red Essential Orchard, or the Essential Red Orchard. No, they're just going to be called The Orchard, although the bosses of Red Essential are going to run the UK division of The Orchard moving forward. So it is a merger rather than a takeover, even though they are getting rid of both the Red brand and the Essential brand.
Yeah, so you can read more on those stories or any of the stories discussed in this week's podcast if you go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast. Find the notes for this show. Links will be in there. And finally, this week, let's bring it round to politics again and Theresa May, who this week, it's looking likely, and by the time you hear this, probably will already have featured in this week's UK singles chart. So that's nice for her.
Possibly at the top of this week's singles chart. That would be nice, wouldn't it? Being number one in the charts of the week of the general election. Who wouldn't want that?
Yes, so her position as UK Prime Minister may no longer be quite so assured, but she looks pretty certain to do very well in the singles charts, although it is a song that accuses her of being a liar, so she may not be celebrating quite as much as she might have been.
Yeah, this is a track in which she appears, but not voluntarily, not out of choice, basically.
I may have misrepresented it slightly.
Clips of her speeches and interviews have been sampled and dropped into this track called Liar Liar by a London outfit called Captain Scar, and they've put it out ahead of the general election. It's actually a track that they originally put out in the early days of the coalition government. Do you remember that?
Yeah, back in 2010.
All seems like a rosy, happy days now, doesn't it? But in response to Cameron and Clegg forming the coalition government, this London ska outfit released this track called Liar Liar back in sort of 2010. It got a tiny little bit of traction online at the time, but nothing like it's been getting in the last week. I think it charted at something like, well, very low in the chart. And by that, I mean the whole chart, not the top 40. So I think it went in at like 84 or something, which probably meant that it sold 22 copies. So didn't get that much traction last time round, but they have remixed it. They've put Theresa May's speeches in there, and then basically the chorus that follows all of the things Theresa May says is just liar, liar, no, no, no. So basically the lyrics suggest that everything that Theresa May has said in the samples is a lie, and so they put it out last week, and yeah, by the middle of the week it was already in the top 10 in the midweeks, and it may well go to the top of the charts this week through both download sales and Spotify streams. And that has created a question of whether or not the old Radio 1 chart show and whatever the commercial radio chart show is called these days, whether or not they should play it, particularly if it is the number one single as we go into general election week.
Yes, because, well, like in 2013, when Margaret Thatcher died and Ding Dong the Witch is Dead went to number two in the charts, it did leave the producers of the Radio 1 chart show in a slight dilemma over whether they should play it or not. In that case, they didn't play it, but they did do a little feature on why it was in the chart.
Yeah, so I suppose in that scenario, that was a taste issue, wasn't it? So yes. it was still the days where... But that brief period in musical history where people would start Facebook campaigns to try and get tracks to number one by people buying them on iTunes. Margaret Thatcher died, I think it's fair to say, a very divisive figure in British political history that some people love, some people hate. And so, yes, that Facebook campaign got Ding Dong, The Wicked Witch is Dead, to number two. And so there was the big debate, should we play this, should we not play this? It sort of feels like it's in bad taste. So yeah, the BBC's solution was to run a little news item, wasn't it, in the middle of the top 10.
Yes.
Someone from Newsbeat coming in explaining why it was that this track was at number two in the charts. But this isn't a taste issue. I mean, there may be a case of defamation. I don't know. You would have to go and assess what it is Theresa May is saying and whether or not she is indeed lying. That's another debate. But I suppose the issue for the BBC and for commercial radio here, because they're all governed by the same rules, is political impartiality, particularly as we go into general election week.
Yes, that's exactly what the BBC has said in a statement this week, that it can't play the song because of Ofcom rules on impartiality during an election campaign.
So even if it is in at number one on Friday, you will not get to hear this song on the Radio 1 chart show. I think commercial radio has been basically saying the same. Certainly no radio station is playing this track, so it is social media that is getting it up the charts. It is on YouTube, but YouTube doesn't chart return, remember? So if you want to be part of the mission of getting this song to number one, you'll either have to buy it on iTunes or stream it on Spotify a lot. But it looks likely that it's definitely going to chart top 10 this week, and that's quite amusing. But yeah, they can't play it because of the old Ofcom rules that say they can't be overtly political.
Yeah, so that's all we've got time for this week. As we've already discussed, we will not be here next week. But if you are at MeDem, do go and find Chris Cook.
Yes.
And listen to him talk about safe harbours, because I'm sure it's something you'll be hankering for if you're a regular podcast listener. I'm sure there will be a very interesting discussion.
It will be.
I shouldn't talk down our event.
Also, I'm moderating it, so you won't actually have to listen to me say all that much. So that's the particularly good news.
Yeah, I suspect you will talk, though, because that's what you do, isn't it?
So yeah, we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Obviously, if you're in the UK, there's a general election before then, so vote. I know that's a really patronising thing to say, but that's what everyone's saying at the moment, isn't it? Vote in the election.
Do vote, though.
And we'll be back the following week, and we may or may not talk about the general election, but I'm sure we'll have lots of other music industry stuff to talk about.
Yes, just remains for me to do the final credits. So, this podcast is presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Take your sheet off.
Yeah, I am. Oh,
goodbye.
Relief. Yeah, don't leave me. Oh, I have been cut off. Should probably stop this recording.